often some of the biggest challenges we have in healthcare are because of issues within the relationship between these formally trained clinicians and people with the illness. And so having a peer specialist involved in care has a very demonstrable change in the way that those people respond to their own illness, to care. Peer specialists have experiential knowledge. They know what the experience is like to have an illness, to be in treatment, and to recover. That's an area of expertise that is extremely valuable. It helps people struggling or trying to recover in ways that objective knowledge does not do.
It's hardly news that those experiencing addiction recovery face many challenges. Sometimes, on the road to recovery, it is helpful to engage with others that have faced the same challenges. Those who have attended support group meetings, such as Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcanon, can speak to the value of that support. But there is a growing effort to bring more of that support into the traditional clinical and case management system with professional recovery support specialists. This is Random Acts of Knowledge, presented by Heartland Community College. I'm your host, Steve Fast. Today we're speaking with an expert on peer support specialists, individuals like those who graduate from the Heartland Community College Recovery Support Specialist Program, help others develop and strengthen their ability to maintain their recovery from substance abuse and mental health disorders.
My name is Chuck Driving. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've worked most of my career in the Veterans Administration. I started out as a clinician, and then I did research, and then I was a manager. So I was responsible for mental health programs, working with veterans, trying to find ways to help them deal with mental health issues.
So as you say, you've spent a lot of your career studying recovery-oriented care. How do you define the role of a peer support specialist in today's behavioral health system?
Peer support specialist is a paid position. There are a few exceptions where the people do this as a volunteer role, but it's a paid position where the qualifications are that the person has to have personal experience with having an illness, being involved in treatment, at least some recovery from that illness, and they have to be willing to talk openly about that experience to other people.
Does that experience have to only be for folks that are in recovery, or can it be people that have in some other way had addiction affect their lives?
There is a valuable role for people who are family members of people who had addiction or a mental illness affect their lives. That's a relatively small group of people that in the United States right now. Other countries have a much bigger group of people who are just family members, because that experience is very valuable. They tend to be very effective coaches for family members and friends of these folks. In the United States, that is a small but growing portion of the number of people who are being peer specialists.
What makes this role particularly unique, and how does it benefit the system in a way that, say, the traditional case management roles can't?
Sure. Traditional healthcare is provided by people who go to school and are given a lot of knowledge about illness and about treatment and what should happen. That's objective knowledge. It's useful. It's helpful. Peer specialists have experiential knowledge. They know what the experience is like to have an illness, to be in treatment, and to recover. That's an area of expertise that is extremely valuable. It helps people struggling or trying to recover in ways that objective knowledge does not do. They tend to have a different type of relationship than clinicians do with people. And often some of the biggest challenges we have in healthcare are because of issues within the relationship between these formally trained clinicians and people with the illness. And so having a peer specialist involved in care has a very demonstrable change in the way that those people respond to their own illness, to care, to, you know, their relationship with actually the formal providers, and the way they think about recovery.
So talk a little bit about that and the role that the support specialists, peer support specialists have. I know a lot of times clinicians are very busy people, and you know, you think about that, they have an appointment or they have their rounds and they interact with patients in very structured ways and just say, this is what we see, this is what you should do, here's your medication, et cetera, et cetera. At what point do the peer support specialists interact, and what's their role that they would have contact or touch points with
This varies by the program that they're working within. So, but in general, I think there's a couple key places that peers are placed to maximize their impact. One is at the front door of a clinical program. We had programs where the first person that any client would meet with was a peer who had been through that program. So you can imagine we had a program to help people go back to work, which is tends to be a scary option. If somebody has had an addiction or a mental illness and has failed multiple times at work, going back to work is something that feels threatening and challenging. They remember their failures, and so they're nervous about it. But if the first person you meet is somebody who had the same experience and can say, "I was sitting in your chair 3 years ago, and now I'm working, and I have good income, and I'm doing fine," it changes the way people feel about their hopefulness about their own success and about the treatment they're about to enter. So the front door is a key place. Another place is the back door. Often in mental health services, the transition out of treatment back to the community is a challenging place where many people get stressed and anxious, and that leads to relapse for plenty of people. Reconnecting with the community is not necessarily an easy thing, but that typically is, clinicians are not real involved in that. And I think they have a different credibility again about that. Having somebody who has transitioned themselves back to the community and is a member of the community and has relationships with other people in recovery in that community is very powerful for those people who are leaving treatment, which has been helpful, but they don't know what's ahead for them. They don't really know what extended recovery looks like. Here's somebody right in front of them who they can ask questions to or can give encouragement to them who has lived that. So that the back door is a key place for peers. And then in the middle is a key place too. Many people drop out of treatment. Many people have challenges, in relating to clinicians or having hopefulness about their own recovery. The treatment can be challenging, and so people get discouraged. Like, I don't know that if I'm going to be successful. And again, having somebody along with you who's not someone with a graduate degree who doesn't talk about their personal experience, but just tells you facts or information, but somebody who can say, who talks very openly about the struggles and the challenges of being in treatment, but also the successes and the payoff for being in treatment, that is a very persuasive role to help people work as hard as they can in treatment, to be as hopeful about their own success and to continue to work through problems with clinicians when they arise, and they often arise.
So how integrated is this role, this peer support specialist role, in our system right now? Do we see it strongly integrated? Is it depending on whether the institution is bought into it? Where do we see areas of growth and areas of effectiveness? And what would you like to see it implemented?
It's still, I'd say, it's still in its infancy. When I was a program manager of the VA, because of the strong connection between veterans, the VA was one of the first adopters of these positions. We quickly hired 20 peer specialists, full-time peer specialists at my VA. The VA hired 1,000 peers right off the bat. There's where some of the mistakes were made. I think that they didn't recognize the importance of training. Most clinicians get years of training to be in their role and to navigate healthcare systems. But the peers typically have gotten a week or 2 weeks of full-time training, and then they pass a test and they're qualified to do that role, which led early on to mistakes by peers, and I think clear mistakes by managers and supervisors in how they use peers. So that slowed down the process of adaptation, of adoption of peers into these roles. The success still carried it forward. The VA, I think, now employs about 2,000 peers. I see them a lot of other places. Researchers got very excited about this and came in and started doing studies to see how peers can address different challenges to healthcare. And their studies found wonderful success in lots of innovative uses of peers to help in mental health, in substance use treatment, increasingly now in medical care, in cancer care, in heart disease, diabetes, weight loss, all of those things. Peers are now being used to address problems where people are not progressing or having real challenges in working with that type of treatment. And peers, of course, are quite good at helping people be hopeful and persistent in what they need to do to be a successful patient. And so I see it, different places really either have, they really get it, and they are using peers in lots of different roles, putting them in the community, putting them inside different kinds of programs, and using them, including them in committees in the way that the healthcare organizations work, and letting them help change the culture of those organizations. And then there's other places that are sitting on the sidelines, not doing much of anything. And unfortunately, there's people in the middle who kind of do it halfway. They know that this is something other people are excited about. They hire a few peers. They don't really use them that well. They don't really understand how to use them. And those, they make mistakes. And then it feels like it confirms to them that this was really not a great idea. That's unfortunate. I think, again, we need to follow the leadership of the people who get it and are using these peers successfully, and the researchers who are giving us hard data to show that peers really do improve the quality of care.
Going back a little bit to what you were talking about with your experience with the VA and the VA being a place where they implemented this concept pretty early, I think that that is an interesting place to start it because so often veterans do have a connection with other veterans. It is something that it's a shared experience for a lot of folks. And do you find that that is to see somebody as a peer, that's probably some people connect and some people don't, even though that they may or may not have gone through the same struggle. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the benefit of just, well, really just kind of that support element of it, of somebody that has a similar experience.
Veterans, because of their experience in the military, they are almost always placed in groups and put into intense, challenging situations with these other people. And if you've ever read anything about like combat veterans, their experiences, they end up fighting for each other. The bonds between them are incredibly intense. I have plenty of older veterans say to me, "I love my wife, I love my family, but I am most strongly connected to those people that I fought with because of the intensity of the experience." And so, absolutely, the voice of other veterans was very persuasive with veterans that we were working with. And so for the VA, the opportunity to have this very powerful voice of somebody who's been through recovery influencing people who need to face the challenge of recovering from something and engaging in treatment, that was a no-brainer. They knew that that was going to be useful, and it was a quick payoff for the VA. This is true for civilians too, that if we look at peer support groups like AA or NAMI groups, the reality is that network of peer support groups where people go in the evening, maybe once a week, to go meet with their group of people who have clinical problems, that network is so helpful that now there's more visits to peer support groups than there are to mental health professionals. Clearly, there's no financial incentive to drive all that, but it is very big and very successful because, it works for people. People really do like that voice of somebody who's a little ahead of them in recovery saying, "This is what happened to me. This might be helpful to you." People need and value that when they hear it. Not everybody loves the input of every peer specialist, but in general, this role of the voice of a peer within illness and recovery is something people respond to fairly quickly, and they value it. Again, that's why there's been this rapid growth in this relatively invisible network of peer support groups, which are now spreading to medical care too. So there's peer support groups for virtually every major medical illness and even life issues that are not, we wouldn't even consider illness. There's peer support groups for those.
So you talked a little bit earlier about the VA taking on to this idea pretty quickly and throwing a lot of people essentially at the problem, but not trained people. What are some of the mistakes or wrong approaches that a peer support person can make if they don't have, I guess, the right kind of training, if they haven't gone through a program and gotten, certified, or if they haven't gone through the process to approach patients in a certain way? What are the vital things they need to learn to avoid some mistakes?
So one of them, I think that a common one is healthcare is a pretty complex place to work. There's different kinds of programs, different kinds of professions that are all working there, collaborating. There's a lot of rules because of the health risk, because of the people who oversee healthcare. So there's all these rules. And when we just train somebody for a week or two and then put them into it, they're going to stumble over those rules. And they actually will assume that actually all they need to do is do what they were trained to do. And the reality is that they need to be able to attend to all those rules so they can navigate that successfully and bring the wonderful service that they have to those clients. If they don't know the rules well enough to navigate it carefully, they also don't have experience in those settings to know that there's political things they have to attend to and there's social things they have to attend to between staff, and they don't really understand their role versus a clinician's role. That sometimes creates tensions within the organization or sometimes creates tensions within the clinicians, and that's okay. Then they can stumble in ways that cause some of their partners to back away or for them to lose confidence in what they're doing. So I think that's one key area, which is why the training really needs to be not just information, but actually supervised experience in the clinical settings so that they can say to their supervisor, why did things happen this way? Why do they happen that way? And the supervisor can explain why that complex setting is the way it is. I think anybody needs to learn lessons about, how you work with the range of different people. Even though peers share experience with their clients are still very different from them in lots of different ways. People are amazingly different as individuals. And over time, experienced peers, you learn, this client is kind of like in that pattern, so I need to adapt my approach in this way. Clinicians get trained for years before they're actually turned loose to do their own clinical work because of that, because the work is complex and they learn how to work with different kinds of people. For peers, if you're just thrown right in there, you can assume that everyone's going to be like you, but they're not. They're all complex in their own way. And you just have to adapt your work a little bit for different personality styles, different situations, so that you can be most effective.
Let's talk a little bit about that. You say that some peer support specialists might think, okay, yeah, everybody will maybe have the same experience as me and have to identify that and in a different person. How does that deal with the benefit of having this role is that they can sort of integrate and interact with folks in a way that clinicians don't necessarily do? But how important is it for them to understand kind of where the boundaries are and how do they learn about those boundaries? And can they easily overstep those boundaries and then not be as effective?
Absolutely. So that is a key concept in the training and role of peers is boundaries. Boundaries between them and their client, boundaries between them and the clinicians, the boundaries around the program that they're working in. So they're inside the boundary with these other clinicians. They are team members there. And when peers are not attentive to those boundaries, they can stumble. Many of the people that we serve in mental health clinical programs have problems with boundaries. That's part of the illness that they're struggling with. And so they can, will have behaviors that will tangle clinicians and peers in that issue and create problems. I've seen multiple situations where clients start to try to treat peers as though they're friends or as romantic interests. As soon as you breach some of those boundaries, your effectiveness is degraded significantly, and you can actually get into ethical trouble based on the ethics guidelines for the state or for that organization. So that boundary concept is very important and needs good training there. Typically, when people do start stumbling over boundaries, their effectiveness does go down. People's trust in them, that they understand where they're working and what they're doing, is lowered, both from the client side and from the other clinicians who are the peers' team members. They're their collaborators.
You mentioned a few things there that might be problems addressed by training. But once somebody is in this role, What are some things that you commonly see happen? Is this something where there might be a lot of burnout, where people are encountering, you know, some intense situations? Anytime you're dealing with somebody with addiction or mental illness, there can be issues where it can get intense. It can be concerning. I know that you have a blog where you talk about some of the issues of this profession. What are some of the things that you think people need to kind of get help with once they're on the job?
So for mental health professionals, they know that they are going to need support through their whole career, that you have a supervisor who's not just responsible for like giving you evaluations and stuff like that, but that you meet with them regularly. You talk about your work. They're a more experienced, seasoned clinician who gives you guidance, who encourages you, who points out your successes and your failures, and keeps pushing you to be better and better at what you're doing. That helps you keep up your morale when you're working in a place where, you know, this is challenging work, that some of the people you're working with are not going to do well. You're down in the trenches with people who are really struggling. It tends to be emotionally challenging work. But having a strong supervisor and a strong organization around you saying, you know, we are just going to keep building your skills. You're going to get better and better, more and more effective. And we are going to be, you know, have higher and higher success rates with the people we work with. That helps kind of battle and fight that sense of discouragement that can come in emotionally challenging work like this. You know, peers need good supervisors who know how to do this. That's also a gap, I think, that in some organizations, they've been given really good supervisors, and actually peers have been promoted to roles where their, you know, experienced peers are supervising less experienced peers. That's ideal. That's the way it should be. When they're not given good supervision, or they're not given supervision by people who have the experience and understanding of that role, they don't get that level of support. That's when they run into the problems I think you're referring to, which is, you know, you deal with folks who are very, very ill, or whose situation is very dark, and you're in there trying to help, and sometimes that doesn't happen, and you're right there with the person, and you've gotten to care about them as your client, and you see the tragedy of the illness damaging their life. That can really hurt morale. I do know people who have left the field because that's been discouraging to them. One of the things that clinicians get trained in is how to protect yourself from that, because, again, we're working in very challenging places. How do you protect yourself emotionally so that you can keep on working year after year, bringing good things to as many clients as you can? And peers need that as well. They need those strategies for protecting themselves and looking for successes and working hard for the next client who's going to do well.
You mentioned that there is a pathway perhaps to becoming a supervisor. As a career, if somebody is interested in pursuing this, maybe it suits their background. This is basically an entry-level position once you get the training. So what kind of pathway is it for somebody that is looking to do this, you know, to make a living for many years?
So I think there, again, the field has some challenges there, but I do see people making pathways. One of the things the VA experienced, because they were early in this, is they realized, actually, if we don't create a pathway for these folks, plenty of them will leave. So they created there's two levels of supervisors. So now you can be a peer, you get promoted within the peer position, and you make more and more money until you get to a level where you've been there at least 5 years, and then your salary starts to level off, but then you can be promoted two more levels of supervisor above that. That was primarily designed to make sure that there's a pathway forward for talented peers to stay in that organization for many, many years and bring that experience and expertise into those clinical programs. That started to happen in other organizations now that have had peers for years. They're starting to look for pathways. I have also known peers to, at some point, feel like, you know, I actually really want to learn some more clinical skills. And they go back and become certified mental health counselors or social workers. And yet, at the same time, some of them have stayed within peer work. Some of them have actually just moved into clinical work and yet they still talk about their experiences in a peer way. So I think there's a couple different pathways that I see peers taking to stay within this field. And my hope is the organizations are going to continue to look for ways to add more opportunities for people to advance, make more money, to develop better expertise, but still keep this voice.
Well, Chuck, thanks so much for joining us today. Before we let you go, if there's any resources, or I know you have a website, and of course you've written about this as well, have a book. Could you tell us a little bit about how people can find more information if they are interested in this field, or if they're working in this field, or if just in general they are interested in this element of our mental health and healthcare system?
Sure. I think there are growing resources for peers. I do have a blog and some books, but there's a bunch of other very good books. NAMI, other national organizations focused on SAMHSA, focused on mental health recovery, have gotten very excited about peer specialists in this role and have developed resources. You can go online and find those. There is a page on my blog that's got just links to other organizations that are doing this kind of work and creating opportunities. So I think there's a lot of good resources there for people, and I hope they do pursue their interest.
And they can find your blog at charlesdrebbing.com with one B, correct?
Correct.
All right. Well, Chuck, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you talking about this.
All right, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Charles Drebbing is a clinical psychologist who has been working with peer support specialists for the past 15 years. He is the author of Helping Others Engage in Needed Services, a pocket resource for peer support specialists and outreach workers, as well as other books. If you're interested in other interviews about health sciences, mental health support, or other topics, subscribe to Random Acts of Knowledge on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you heard this one. Thanks for listening.